From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Yesterday, President Obama and Russian President Medvedev signed the biggest nuclear arms agreement in a generation. This hour, University of Iowa political science professor William Reisinger will explain this latest historic arms pact. Also, professor of Russian Margaret Mills will tell us about a new $75,000 federal grant for 12 UI students to study intensive advanced Russian language and culture at the UI and in Russia. Then in the second half hour, we listen back to an interview from last year with University of Iowa English professor Jeff Porter. He'll tell us about the art of storytelling for the ear. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, as I'm sure you heard in the news, the U.S. and Russia signed their first strategic arms treaty in nearly two decades. It aims to draw down their nuclear arsenals by as much as one-third while forging improved relations between the former Cold War rivals. We want to take a closer look at this latest historic arms pact in the context of U.S.-Russian relations with my first guest today, William Reisinger, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Welcome to our studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Professor Reisinger.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the U.S. and Russia possess together 95% of the world's nuclear weapons, as I understand it. What specifically does this arms agreement require the U.S. and Russia to do?
Well, it requires them to dismantle and take out of deployment significant numbers of both launchers or delivery vehicles, as they're sometimes called, the actual rockets that can propel the bombs to the other country, as well as warheads themselves as a separate criterion, because each rocket can carry multiple warheads that are independently targeted. So, in effect, one delivery vehicle can reach many sites in the other country's side. And just to give you some numbers, 20 years ago, before the current round of cutting through the START negotiations began, the United States and Russia both possessed over 2,200 delivery vehicles or launchers on each side, and the current agreement will reduce that number to a limit of 700 for each of the countries. Now, that's 700 that are actually deployed and put into use. The other numbers are warheads. Each side had over 10,500 20 years ago, and the current agreement calls for that to be reduced to 1,550 on each side.
Take us back to the reasons that we got to this point. Thousands of warheads here, and as I understand it, each of these warheads much more powerful, destructive than the Hiroshima or Nagasaki warheads. How did we figure we needed so many warheads?
Well, there was a process of competition between the two sides that was really based on fear of the other side possibly launching a first strike that would debilitate the other country's forces so much that no retaliation would be possible, no real war could be actually fought, and that a country could lose all its valued people and cities and possessions in one fell swoop. And that led to increasing rivalry to have more arms than the other side, and it led to pressures to not let the other side have even one iota more of this kind of weapon or that kind of weapon.
Political pressures on each side.
Yeah.
How does this fit into the President Obama's long-range vision that he outlined also in his campaign for a world without nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it's a very attractive goal. It is this current agreement, I think, takes an important step toward that. It is indeed a very significant step in that direction. Now, reaching that goal will be much more difficult. The Russians, for example, are much less sanguine about such a goal even than the Obama administration or even than some Obama administration critics here, because in a world without nuclear weapons, then the United States' dominance in conventional weapons will be even more pronounced.
Okay. Now, some people may be asking how such a drastic cut in U.S. nuclear, the arsenal, will not result in less security for us. Are we any less safe because we have these thousands of fewer warheads and launchers available to us?
Well, I think scenario for the United States is that we really have goals of nonproliferation and relations with other major powers such as Russia and China that don't strategy doesn't rely on the nuclear weapons being used. We have an offensive nuclear arsenal as a deterrent against other scenarios, but we really have superiority in deployment of conventional forces in a whole variety of ways that allow us to achieve strategic and tactical goals around the world. So in that sense, reducing this can help us in reaching some goals without hurting our ability to have a nuclear deterrent. And so for the United States, this is really, I think, a strong step forward.
So it has been also with the help of progress in our conventional weaponry, the high-tech weaponry that we hear about every day, has allowed people to be reassured that also in part that we can do without these.
Absolutely. The United States continues to really be in the forefront of the technological innovation that is driving conventional warfare.
I wanted to play you a little cut, and perhaps our listeners heard this earlier in the week. David Folkenflik of NPR reported on this newscast. This is a cut from Fox News earlier this week. Listen in to how this this historic pact is portrayed here by Megyn Kelly of Fox News.
And President Obama heading for the Czech Republic as we speak, set to sign a new nuclear pact with Russia. Now critics are asking, will the new deal leave the U.S. defenseless until it's too late? Coming up next hour.
So at this point in Fox News, you saw there with that explosion, archival footage of some kind of mushroom cloud. What are your thoughts, Professor Reisinger, when you see coverage like this? Raising legitimate concerns that we should talk about? Or in this way, are we stoking some Cold War fears that we need not worry about?
Well, closer to the latter, I am not a journalist by training, but I certainly think that the use of the mushroom cloud video was not very responsible, and it doesn't lead to very useful debates on the matter. What it does to me highlight is the degree to which this, as most other issues now, will be caught up in some very bitter partisan debates in Washington. And the American foreign policy consensus that held for many decades after World War II has certainly broken down. So it's very unclear at this point whether the Senate will ratify this on the grounds of sort of politics stops at the water's edge, mm-hmm. or whether the race for the midterm elections is what's going to determine the politics of this.
Paul from Solon got a jump on the emails. I want to mention our email address for us. The email is theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Or if you have other questions and concerns, you want to voice by telephone, 1-866-780-9100. Right before the show started, we received this email from Paul in Solon, which goes to your point, Professor Reisinger. The history of ratification of strategic arms control treaties has been that there is broad bipartisan consensus when treaties are considered by the U.S. Senate, which has to ratify this one, of course, as well. And Paul writes, according to today's Wall Street Journal, the White House has already attempted to avoid party line divisions by emphasizing that strategic arms control treaties have historically been bipartisan affairs, including the Moscow Treaty. To what extent, asks Paul, is this history relevant to New START and its prospects for ratification?
Well, I think that the history is relevant. It certainly provides members of the Senate with an image of their body and its role in American politics that they can hearken back to. But this is a different Senate than existed at the time of previous treaties, and there's no guarantee. I think one of the key things is that the health care bill is now passed, and that debate is over. And so the decks have been cleared a little bit for new deals and new politicking in the months ahead. And that may give the Obama administration a window to get this thing passed.
So a chance for the rancor from that debate over a year to settle a bit, mm-hmm. so that we can be more bipartisan.
Well, and for one bill not to be held hostage as the other is pursued, and those kind of trade-offs.
What's in it for Russia? How do they see this pact, the government, and also its people?
Well, I think for Russia, there are two very clear pluses. One is that they need to save money. Their economy has been hit by the global financial crisis very hard, but also they need to modernize and diversify their economy and reform their military in ways that cost money. So anything that can be saved by maintaining a smaller nuclear arsenal will be very welcome on the economic side. The other thing is the prestige of signing a treaty such as this with the United States and for at least a brief moment being seen on the world stage as a co-equal superpower with the United States and one of the two major nuclear powers in the world, reminding the world of that. So those are good for Russians. I think the public would share those perceptions.
The U.S. has indicated a clear need for Russia to agree on sanctions against Iran. How could this pact affect that prospect?
Well, you know, it seems that negotiations about Russia joining us in sanctioning Iran have been ongoing, and President Medvedev at the end of the signing ceremony made some statements that went a little farther toward the U.S. position than we've heard in a while. So I think there is room for the United States and Russia to become stronger allies in trying to deal with Iran. Now, on the other hand, the foreign minister of Russia on the same day made statements that showed that Russia will probably not want to cooperate on issues like Iran with the United States unless the U.S. is going to make some concessions on the missile defense issue in Europe, which the Russians continue to see as very threatening.
Mm. What could signing this pact improve other areas of tension between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, I think it does improve the general U.S.-Russian relations, which have been very problematic in recent years, and the Obama administration has been trying to push the reset button on, as they said. So this is another step forward in that regard. And to what degree it translates into more concrete achievements between the two countries will depend on further talks. But mm-hmm. I think it sets a tone of cooperation that will help those talks.
Overall, when we look at Russian-U.S. relations, also going back through the Bush administration, 8 years of the Bush administration, was there any high point like this, apparent high point in the Bush administration, or is this the high point in the last decade, really?
The high point in the Bush administration came in the months after 9/11, when Vladimir Putin was one of the first to express condemnation of the attacks and to call on President Bush, really, to create an alliance against global terrorism, which has affected Russia, of course, even very recently through the subway bombings in Moscow.
Okay, very good. We'll have to take a short break and be back in just about a minute. Continuing our conversation with University of Iowa political science professor William Reisinger, latest on the historic arms pact in the context of U.S.-Russian relations. When we come back, I want to talk about a grant. Just a few days ago, the University of Iowa announced it will receive a $75,000 federal grant for 12 University of Iowa students to study intensive advanced Russian language and culture at the UI and in Russia. When we come back, professor of Russian Margaret Mills will join us to tell us about this grant, also to find out what kind of priority Russian language skills and expertise have in this country post-Cold War era. Your questions and comments, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Back with The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you could join us. Monday on this program, we learn about a new project by the Office of the State Archaeologist that will use airborne lasers to survey hundreds of Native American burial grounds in Iowa. Also, Professor of Natural History, Physics, and Astronomy Marcelo Gleiser on his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. In it, Gleiser puts forth a radical new vision for life in the universe. That coming up Monday in this hour of The Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio. Today talking about Russia and the U.S. in light of the historic arms agreement that was signed yesterday. And just a few days ago, the University of Iowa announced it will receive a $75,000 federal grant for 12 University of Iowa students to study intensive advanced Russian language and culture at the UI and in Russia. Joining us now from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, we have Professor Margaret Mills, professor of Russian at the University of Iowa, also chair of the university's Department of Asian and Slavic Languages and Literature. Good afternoon. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you, Ben. It's my pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about this federal grant and what it allows for. What will these students be doing in Russia and at the UI?
Well, it's coincidental. I just picked up the actual grant notification award from the Department of Education on my way to the studio this morning. So I'm kind of still excited and not quite believing that our students at Iowa will have the opportunity to study Russian intensively, all paid for, 3 weeks at the University of Iowa next May in a 90-hour-a-week Russian boot camp that will prepare them to travel to Moscow to our partner institution, which is called the Plekhanov Academy of Economics. And there they'll study intensive Russian 5 hours a day, live with Russian families, and have the opportunity to take the Russian version of the TOEFL test that will allow our students to study at the undergrad and graduate level in Moscow and Petersburg and any Russian Federation university. Mm. So we're just thrilled for our students.
Just curious, in a language boot camp, what is the linguistic equivalent of a push-up? give me 60.
I can tell you right now, it's conjugating verbs of motion with prefixes. And I think Professor Reisinger would agree with me on that one.
Absolutely.
Mention again, if you just joined us, University of Iowa political science professor William Reisinger with us as well. And so let's talk a little bit about the test of Russian as a foreign language. What does this mean? Explain how this fits in and why it's important to our country.
It is a fairly new exam that is certified by the Russian Ministry of Education and Science to encourage international students to pursue undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral training in Russian universities. Russia is undergoing a fantastically interesting and major renovation in its educational system. It's renovating its system of higher education according to the Bologna Accords so that diplomas are from Russia to Eastern Europe to Western Europe are received without any questions, and students and graduates can get jobs on the basis of their Russian or Czech or Croatian diplomas. And so this renovation in their higher education system is really drawing and attracting international students to come and study in Russia. Mm-hmm. And in my history of teaching Russian at the University of Iowa for 20 years, and having been a student of Russia since 1977, I can say that one is not going to learn Russian effectively to help in any job or cultural diplomacy unless they study intensively in mm-hmm. Russia.
Mm-hmm. When you look, Professor Mills, watch the news media, hear our news and so mm-hmm. forth, and talk about the high-level diplomatic exchanges between the U.S. and Russia and the to and fro at that high level, how much does it mirror the contact at a lower level, the cultural level, the language level between the two countries? Or do they match at all? Or,
well, it's interesting. That's a very good question. I think as political relations warm and start to grow, I believe that not only is our own Department of Education, State Department, more interested in enhancing and expanding the study of things Russian, including language, literatures, culture, political science, business, there is a definite trickle-down to professors, universities, and students.
Mm-hmm. Since the end of the Cold War, and it's hard to believe, now almost two decades ago,
right.
Has the U.S. State Department continued to place a priority on maintaining Russian language and Russian specialists?
After the fall of the Soviet Union in 91, federal funding for the study of Russian just fell through the floor.
The need was gone. Many felt
the need was gone. They're our friends. They're an emerging democracy. They speak English, and it's quite true that on the streets of Moscow and Petersburg and Kazan today, the average person 30 or under does speak quite decent English because of the opening of the media, and now it's going the other direction. But opening of the media for American and Western European television channels, MTV, radio shows. But as a result of this loss in federal funding, many departments around the country were closed. Many programs were closed. Most of the high schools that taught Russian language, and there were many, many of them funded by federal sources throughout the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they've almost all disappeared.
And now?
And now, as of 3-4 years ago, thanks to The initiative, both by the Russian Ministry of Education and the United States Ministry of Education, they have launched joint initiatives where each side is funding these kinds of partnership grants with Russian institutions of higher learning and American universities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're very fortunate 3 years ago to be selected as one of the first.
We want to have just a few minutes left in our conversation. An email came in a few minutes ago from James in Des Moines, which harkens back to our discussion with William Reisinger on the political end of our discussion about U.S., the United States, and Russia. Russia appears, writes James of Des Moines, more vulnerable in the wake of recent bombings and attacks. Could those attacks lead to a stronger bond between the U.S. and Russia, better collaboration in dealing with Islamic extremists?
Well, they very well might. They certainly did in 2001, too, and up until around 2003 at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which threw things back kind of onto the shoals. I certainly hope they will. I think those are the issue of regional conflicts and other global issues that are outside the typical arms control kind of sphere are something where Russia and the United States tend to share a lot of common interests. And so hopefully that's a path forward.
Now, back to you, Professor Mills, on the language front. At the University of Iowa, this is a new grant, but the University of Iowa is coming to the last few months of a larger grant, a $360,000 grant, a Russia-U.S. initiative grant. Tell us about that grant and what's been accomplished during the period.
It's been extraordinarily interesting for our university, the University of UNI, whom we cooperated with, and the Plekhanov Academy of Economics, that has resulted in 15 University of Iowa students being trained in advanced Russian for 3 weeks in March 09, in this past March. They all took this TOEFL test. They've all passed, and so they've received a green light to go to study further in Russian universities. We've trained, are currently training five professors from Moscow. Thanks to our excellent ESL program, they're here this week. They'll be here for another week, and they're learning how to teach finance in English to their graduate students in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of UNI professors has gone to Russia twice in the last 2 years to give a lecture series on various aspects of American business practices.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to incorporate language, business, culture, and education. And to date, we've been really, really pleased with the results.
And as I understand, the University of Iowa and the University of Northern Iowa are only a select group that have received this sort of grant money.
That first year, when the two secretaries selected the participants in Moscow, the Russian universities were pre-selected, and the American universities had to write their grant proposal to match the profile of that university. And University of Iowa was only one of three universities to receive that.
Mm-hmm.
The other two were University of Maryland and Indiana University for that first year.
Mm-hmm. Very good. We have come to the end of this segment of our program. I want to thank you very much, Professor of Russian, Peggy Mills, and announcing that new federal grant for 12 University of Iowa students to study intensive advanced Russian language and culture at the UI and in Russia. Also, thanks to University of Iowa political science professor William Reisinger. Thank you both for coming in today.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Coming up in just a moment, we listen back to an interview with University of Iowa English professor Jeff Porter as we examine the art of storytelling. For a number of years, Porter has taught a radio essays course that explores storytelling through the audio medium, the art of storytelling for the ear, and we'll listen to an essay that tells a compelling story utilizing different audio elements. That's when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Storytelling has existed as long as humanity has had language, as a way of passing on culture and lore from generation to generation, a way to educate, to entertain, and to explain the world around us. And it's what those of us who call ourselves news junkies thrive on, stories that are somehow relevant to our lives. Think about it. Just one day of listening to Iowa Public Radio yields more stories than you can remember. Well, right now we'd like to explore the art, the craft of storytelling for the ear. Jeff Porter is an English professor at the University of Iowa, and for many years he's taught a course titled Radio Essays. Jeff Porter joins me in the studio right now. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Ben.
Hey, I understand that you have absolutely no radio background prior to teaching this course, so tell us, how did you come up with being the creator of a Radio Essays course?
Well, about 6 or 7 years ago, I started making nonfiction films. And because I was a writerly kind of guy and text-oriented, I was building my films primarily with the speech of the subjects and with sound and with music. And so what I'd actually do is build a soundtrack that could stand by itself before I actually worked on the visuals. And I found, to my surprise, that it was kind of interesting in that the voicing of various interviewees and subjects, what they were saying changed in relation to what other people were saying and what kinds of music and sounds were layered with those voices. And so I said, you know, this would be kind of cool to actually do in the classroom. I think students could make this happen in just a audio-only environment. And so that was sort of the point of departure for the Radio Essays class. And, of course, around the same time, This American Life was becoming very popular. And so there was a way to pitch it to the students, saying, look at Ira Glass. He's a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And everybody was beginning to listen at that time to Ira Glass. And they were quite taken with David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell. So it was a convergence of my own work and what suddenly was very, very popular on public radio.
In just a few moments, we want to listen to a very moving radio essay, an example from one of your recent classes created by one of the student in your class, Willie Barber. But first of all, so if I were to take your class, what sort of projects would we be doing?
Well, we kind of work according to the difficulty of the program. So we begin simply with two tracks. So people tell stories. The first project is a narrative project, and they tell a story. And we privilege writing. No matter what we do, we're always privileging writing. And so the trick is to kind of turn that written story into a spoken story. And that's very, very interesting for writers especially because they're not used to the difference between spoken language and written language.
Mm-hmm. So in its essence, what is the difference between writing for print and writing for the ear?
Well, you know, words don't make any sound on the page. And so suddenly when they're sounded, some words sound better than others. Some words want to speak out and some words don't. Mm. And so you have to kind of you change your syntax and you change your vocabulary and you have to find different ways to stylistically. I mean, you're talking now about a real voice and not an implied or metaphoric voice when you're doing radio. And so you have to find ways that are acoustic to represent the idea, the feeling, the characters, the things that really matter in your story. And so you're looking, suddenly you're trying to develop a new set of tools to make this happen. And it's partly kind of a translation from written language to spoken language.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine when you're practicing your script, you must encourage your students to speak it out loud before they call it a final version.
Well, they spend a lot of time in front of a microphone freaking out. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, if you're not experienced before a microphone, it's really, really scary. And so they suddenly discover the limits of their own voice, and they also discover that you can rehearse a text. You know, what writer rehearses a text when writing? You revise, but that's not the same thing as rehearsing a text. And so they kind of discover this performative dimension of writing that is, I think, repressed by the printed page.
Well, let's go to this piece. It's a piece that lasts something like 13 minutes by one of your former students, Willie Barber. He submitted it. Let's listen for these things. Now, this is a personal essay that he's done. His specific assignment here.
Yeah, this was the first project we did in that class. It was about a year ago. It was a graduate seminar in the radio essay. It was a nice class. It was a mix of undergrads and grad students. And our grad students were from all over campus. We had people from intermedia, journalism, cinema studies, from nonfiction, from English, from theater. So it was a really, really great mix. And they were they're very, very smart, and they were incredibly productive in our workshops. And I remember Willie's story came in, and it went through a number of changes before it arrived at the stage we're about to hear.
Okay, let's have a listen to that. This is Willie Barber with a very personal essay, including all the things we've been talking about, a lot of great sounds and music. Willie Barber, is a project for Jeff Porter's class, Radio Essays.
I'm in bed, in a room with wire in the glass, surrounded by bodies in white gowns, flowing white gowns like angels at the Christmas pageant, but with masks over their faces. They are pulling at me, poking at me, getting blood and getting urine samples. It was cold, so cold I could not move. I was being forced liquid, cold, frozen liquid, every hour on the hour. The fan was always on. There was no escaping that cold. It was July 1962. It was beginning to be a great summer. My friends and I tore up the streets on our bikes, singing Beach Boys songs as loud as we could over the rhythm of the playing cards close pinned into the spokes of our bikes. She's giving me the excitations. I'm backing up. Great friends, my Stingray bike with a sissy bar, and Dodger games with my dad and my little brother. My father wanted an athlete for his firstborn. When the day arrived, while he sat in the St. John's maternity waiting room, he proclaimed to all, "His name will be William Lansing, and we will call him Lance when he plays ball." For Dad, sports was his entire life, from grade school through college and beyond. While in college, he played in the semi-pros for the Baltimore Orioles minor league team, but had to abandon that when he met and 1 year later married Mom. And then 9 months after that, I showed up, and off he went to work. His dream of playing pro ball, his life's passion abandoned to raise a family, was now going to be manifested by me, Lance, in a long succession of T-ball games, little league games, high school games, college games, and then, maybe, a shot at the pros. Lance was always in the forefront of his dreams until my seventh summer, the summer I contracted spinal meningitis, the summer that Dad's dream of Lance faded away and was replaced by Billy. Needles, needles and pins, pins and needles. I'm laid in a bed, bed and laid, held to the bed, no jammies, only underpants, fan on, always pointing at me. Goosebumps that do not go away, hot goosebumps, frozen insides. Give me a sheet, a blanket, a pillow. Give me anything. Mom, Dad, I see them through the glass. Scared eyes and frantic faces, so different from yesterday. I have a fond memory of post-war Southern California, the idyllic long days of summer that seemed to keep the impending new school year at bay, were perfect for the games the neighborhood gang would play. Every yard on our cul-de-sac, Galt Street in Van Nuys, was fertile ground for forts, cowboys and Indians, tag, water fights, and sleepouts. Vietnam wasn't on our radar, Kennedy was president, and Dad seemed to always have tickets to a great game. That night was no different. Dad at the helm of our new Chevy wagon was ready to head out. My brother and I were fighting over the front seat. I won. I was the oldest. Our fight interrupted his driving ritual, but after admonishment from Mother and her warning to Dad to make sure we wouldn't eat too much junk food, the Barber boys were off. Headed to Chavez Ravine, the recently constructed Dodger Stadium, which in all of its night game brilliance seemed to fill the sky with a heavenly glow. You could see those lights all the way from Pasadena. Brilliant lights, reflecting off the clouds like our own Aurora Borealis. Lights are shifting, shadows bounce off the walls. can't focus. A movement? Mom, is that you? A white angel comes to my bedside. I look up. She points to the window. My mom, her face distorted by the wired glass, looks down, smiles, and her mouth moves. I cannot hear. The glass stops the germs, stops the words. Hour after hour, frozen minutes. I look over to the bed next to me. She has tubes everywhere. She eats through a tube, pees through a tube. Her little limp body makes no dent on the canvas cot that holds her up off the mattress. She does breathe on her own, not infectious. We are not infectious to each other. We talk. I read to her, tell her jokes. She is five. Her name is Sandy. Sandy Koufax was pitching. The chance of the Dodgers breaking some kind of record was always a possibility and was enough to make the trip shorter than usual. The tickets were exchanged, and then a quick run past the Dodger dog stand, past the man with the programs and scorecards, and through the concrete tunnel where the most beautiful sight awaits. Below, stretched out as far as you care to remember, is the green grass of the outfield. It is the most amazing green you've ever seen, a green so vibrant and alive that you'd swear it's one of the players. That view, mixed with the crack of the bats during warm-up, the organ music, and the holler of the boys selling popcorn, peanuts, Cracker Jacks, programs, get your programs here, made a boy feel the way a boy should feel. How do you feel? This is always the question the angels ask when they wake me, each hour on the hour through the long night. I don't say anything. They give me a big, cold glass of milk to drink and then leave. I'm so cold. I close my eyes for a moment. I have to distract myself from the cold. I'll think of jokes to tell Sandy. Why did the silly tiptoe past the medicine cabinet? Because it didn't want to wake the sleeping pills. Or, why do you jump out of an airplane? To test your jumpsuit. She won't like that one. I hide from the cold and fall into a restless, dreamless sleep. How do you feel? William, wake up. It's time for your milk. The voice brings me back to the cold room, but something is wrong. The lights are wrong. It is brighter. Watch out for Sandy's eyes, I start to say as I turn to her bed. There's always a little... The bed next to mine is made in perfection, or the angels made the bed. Dad leaves us alone in our seats right before the fifth inning. Back he came in the second out, beer in one hand and peanuts in the other. We ate that night, forgetting Mom's warning. It was a feast of Oscar Mayer, Dodger dogs, cotton candy, peanuts, Cracker Jacks, and a ton of cola. We were so sick to our stomachs. When we got home, I think we used an entire bottle of Alka-Seltzer. More needles in my back, more blood, more frozen pinpricks. I'm shriveled, I curl into myself, hugging myself. Warmth, I need warmth. Mom, I'm on fire! Burning alive, Mom! I yelled from my bed the next morning. I really don't feel good, Mom. Mom blamed Dad and the food. But when she took my temperature, it was 101. The fever kept climbing no matter what she did. The next morning, with a fever of over 104, and while pushing cold compresses into my neck and head, Mom asked me how I was feeling. I have pins in my bed, was my response. When she told that to the doctor over the phone, he wasted no time in getting over to our house. These were the days that doctors made house calls. And it was not more than 2 hours later I was in the isolation pediatric ward at UCLA Medical Center. I'm alone and the angels haven't come for me yet. They came for Sandy. She died last night. Am I next? Will they come for me soon? I don't know. So I wait. Cold, frozen. I wait. Will the angels come? I have no one to talk to now. I want to read her a story, tell her a joke. Anything to forget the cold, the needles, the stupid fan bolted above the air conditioner and the window blowing down on my body. So I sleep. I must dream of warm places, happy places. Until one morning, when I wake up and I do not feel the fan. I do not remember being woken during the night. The light is brighter. The nurses arrive with caring eyes and warm fingers. Here's a blanket. Here's your favorite jammies. Here's a pillow. The angels unmask. They are strangers, but they have warmth in their eyes. I peer out from under my blanket. I clutch my blanket. I will never give up my blanket. The Dodgers won that game the other night. Lance didn't. The trip home from the hospital was quiet, starting with the wheelchair ride to the car, after the goodbyes on the ward. The wire windows and tile floors morphed to blue skies and concrete as I was wheeled out of the hospital to the waiting station wagon. I didn't get the front seat. I laid down in the back. "Billy, are you okay?" Mom asked and then slipped back into silence as I said yes. Both my parents were so very quiet, each dealing with their own feelings. I didn't know it then, but I suspect now that my father was mourning the loss of Lance. Carrying that ball all the way down the field or catching the pivotal fly ball in the last inning. For me, I had faced death and won, but with consequences. Over time, my mind and body healed, but it had changed. My metabolism shifted. I gained weight, lost not only my father's hopes for me, but also my own boyhood dreams. I never talked to him about that summer. I never talked to him about Lance. I should have. I know he loved me, but I believe Lance came between us every time he was disappointed or angry with me. That unspoken loss, for both father and son, it changed forever our bond. That summer, Lance became Billy.
Been listening to The Billy Machine, a personal essay for radio by University of Iowa graduate student Willie Barber, a project for the class Radio Essays taught by my guest for this portion of the exchange, Professor Jeff Porter of the English Department at the UI. What a gripping essay. He's weaving his childhood together, these two stories, the baseball wishes of his father for Lance, and then Billy there too with this horrible disease. When you look at it as a story, what makes it so gripping?
Listening to these stories reminds me that the meaning of a story sometimes, maybe oftentimes, exceeds its own language. And so much of the stories, this story's evocative power is in Willie Barber's voice, mm-hmm. the way he voices this story. And somehow it seems that he's been able to capture a memory of this little kid in the hospital who is scared, vulnerable, and
goes up into this high register, and you really picture him as a boy.
Yeah, you do. Let me tell you, I remember when Willie's narrative was being workshopped in class, his first cut didn't sound like this at all. Willie has a background in drama and sound design, so what Willie did was he turned this into a one-act play, and he intoned most of the passages, and so it sounded like he was being or trying to be a professional actor, and it didn't have a simulation of the young boy who was scared out of his breeches in that hospital room. Instead, it sounded like, you know, it's
the big announcer voice.
Yeah. And so it was a kind of professionalized voice. And what he did is everyone said, you know, that doesn't work. What you need to do, and it also began with baseball sounds and rock and roll. He began, I think, with a sort of memory of the baseball stadium. And so he said, you know, the hospital, that's the key thing. Begin in the hospital and begin with hospital ambient sounds. And I think that helped Willie capture the image, that sort of that memoiristic image of the little boy.
That really took him back to his childhood, yeah, and those painful memories. We've got about a minute left, Jeff Porter. Quickly, how has the digital age changed storytelling for the ears? How do you see it's opened up technology to access for many people?
Well, you know, everyone can tell a story now, and everyone can broadcast their story. It's so affordable and it's so easy. But I also think there's something interesting going on. You know, all the way back in the days of cassette recording, with the mixtape. The mixtape was really, really big, especially in young people's lives. It was an act of somehow kind of taking over their own culture. And this has happened with mashups, and it's now happening with podcasts. I think young people not only want to tell their own stories, but they want to somehow assimilate and recycle their culture in those stories. And I think that's what the digital platform allows them to do.
Okay, very good. We'll have to leave it there. Jeff Porter, thank you very much for coming in and sharing that piece and sharing your work with your class, Radio Essays. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Jeff Porter specializes in nonfiction writing, digital media, and 20th century literature and culture in the University of Iowa Department of English. He teaches the course Radio Essays. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins with help from Julie Englander and John Pemble. Podcasting available by going to iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.